The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 222.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi, guys. Hope you are well. Welcome to today's live stream. My brain is a little fried. I have to admit, I just got done doing a three-hour interview with Meet Kevin. When you get done doing those interviews, if they're like 45 minutes or an hour, your brain feels like mush. But my goodness, after 3 hours. But it was a great interview. If you guys want more of this type of content, definitely check that out on his channel. We talked about everything regarding the Fed, inflation, the stock market, Bitcoin, gold, real estate, international real estate, and we talked about it all. It was a great conversation. So let's get into the questions. Want to remind everyone about Rebel Capitalist Live. That's the actual live event that I'm doing where people are going to meet each other and hang out and socialize, not on Zoom, face-to-face, believe it or not. It's going to be in Miami, June 11th through the 13th. We've got people like Mike Maloney is going to be there, Lynette Zhang, Jason Hartman, Ken McElroy, Jeff Snyder, Brent Johnson, Lynette Zhang, and more. So if you guys want more information on how you can attend, go to rebelcapitalistlive.com is the web address. Okay, let's dive into the questions. Got Gresham is whispering in my ear to buy Gresham. I don't know if that's a reference to Gresham's Law is whispering in your ear because you see inflation coming and that's the bad money. You're trying to take your good money and buy something that's a hard asset. Oh, no. This is at 0% APR. So I'm guessing that's a new vehicle. No way. I would never buy a new vehicle. I shouldn't say never, but I sure as heck wouldn't do it as an investment to think that you're actually going to make money on it or even break even. Nah, you're just buying a depreciating asset. This thing's going to be worth half in 3 years than what it is today. I wouldn't do that. Now, if you're just buying it because you like it and you know you're going to get your butt handed to you on the depreciation, well, that's a different story. George Gammon, there is a silver short squeeze. Do you think it has a chance of succeeding? No. That's part of what I talked to Kevin about is it's one thing to have a short squeeze where you're dealing with a stock with a market cap of $1 billion or something where there's a very small float. But it's a whole other thing when you're talking about the silver market. And there's just, it'd be very difficult to get that many people to actually buy that would, where you could move the market for a sustainable period of time. And then what I was talking to Kevin about specifically was this Reddit thread about the gentleman who is wanting to, the everything short. He's basically wanting to do a short squeeze on the treasury market, which is, that ain't gonna happen. There's no way. So, I don't think there's a high probability of the silver market. Due to hyperinflation, millennials start to buy houses. Do you think the prices will go down? You use a chart from 1900%, but do you still think we avoid the chart in the system? Oh, I see. So you're talking about the additional demand from house formation or household formation with millennials. They still have to be able to afford the house. I mean, they can want to buy a house all they want, but take it to its extreme. If the cheapest house in the United States was $2 million, I don't care how many millennials are having kids and getting married. They're not going to be able to buy a house. It's too expensive for 99% of them. So houses just can't go up forever. It's nothing just continues to go up to the clouds. At some point, you run out of buyers. In which case prices start to go down. Now, another thing that I'd point out is the chart is still 100% valid because it's based on income. And unless the interest rates are going negative on mortgages, you're not going to get more purchasing power out of the same amount of income. Incomes are going to have to increase and I'm not talking about stimmy checks. I'm talking about sustainable income that's a result of production needs to increase in order for individuals, home buyers, to be able to afford more homes or more of a home. So I think the question really becomes, are you talking about prices going up in nominal terms or prices going up in real terms? Because we could have prices go up in nominal terms for the next 15 years. But in real terms, we could come right back down to the historic trend line that we established from 1900 to 2000. So that's what, you know, people see it as binary, as either prices go up or they go down. Or flat, maybe. But what they don't understand is just because prices go up doesn't necessarily mean that you're increasing your purchasing power. If the prices of goods and services goes up at a faster rate, then you're losing purchasing power. So that's kind of how I think through that question. Can I explain how the government calculates unemployment? How do we have 700K initial unemployment claims each week, but add 917,000 jobs? Well, they're adding jobs that were lost in the first place. I mean, basically the way they measure this is, I should know this right off the top of my head. It's, what is the unemployment? It's U5 and U7, hold on a second, U3 unemployment. So U3 is the unemployment rate that the media tells us about. That's kind of headline unemployment, if you want to think about it that way. And then there's, I believe, U5. Let me just go to shadow stats here real quick, and I know it's right there. Oh, U6. Okay, so it's U6. It goes up to U6. That's right. So it goes U3, U6. So U6 would include individuals who don't have a job but have not looked for a job in the last, I think it's 4 weeks. So most people would still consider those people unemployed. But the government doesn't. The government doesn't. If you haven't looked for a job in the last 4 weeks, even though you don't have a job, the government doesn't consider you unemployed, or they consider you in U6. And the media just never talks about the U6 number. So I'm sure you're asking, what is the U6 number? And let's go back to shadow stats here. U6 right now is about, call it 11% roughly. And then shadow stats has another measurement that includes everyone that's not working. So this U6 number includes everyone that has not looked for a job in the last 4 weeks, but has looked for a job in like the last 6 months or something like, or maybe it's the last year. But what shadow stats does is they say, no. Let's just calculate how many people are unemployed that could be working. So how many people in the age group where we would consider, okay, this is the labor pool, let's say from 18 years to 62 years old. How many Americans are in this group, and how many of them are not working? And that's the shadow stats number. When you look at that, we're at 25%. That's Great Depression. Great Depression levels of unemployment. Now, your question is more so, how can we keep losing all these jobs but then gaining back on net balance? I'm not sure how that number is created, but you got to remember how the jobs that we're gaining, it's not like we're gaining those jobs. We're just bringing jobs back that we had lost before from this staggering amount of job losses we had in 2020 because of the government's response to the cervasive sickness. So if that's your high water mark, I mean, we're not even remotely close to that high water mark.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
What are the probabilities of entering a Great Depression like the Great Depression with the Fed printing endless money supply if interest rates rise, possible increase? Yeah, but what you've got to understand is we could go through a Great Depression that's an inflationary depression. I mean, I would consider a depression just a reduction in economic output or a reduction in real GDP. And we can have nominal GDP go up while at the same time real GDP is going down. So we can have an inflationary depression. And obviously that's what you'd consider Venezuela. That would be an inflationary depression. So I'm not saying the United States gets to the point of being Venezuela, but you can see this, you could see the same dynamics play out. Not now, probably not in 5 years, but you know, 10, 15 years down the line, you could see something like this. The seeds of hyperinflation are being sown as we speak in the United States, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we have hyperinflation. Listen, the seeds of hyperinflation were being sown in the United States 1914 to call it 1918, because the United States was doing things very similarly to Germany. The difference was in the United States, at a certain point, we said no more money printing. We're not going to continue this. We're going to just let the market do what it needs to do and clear out, and we're going to probably go through a pretty severe recession, which we did. In the early 1920s, we went through a Great Depression where the headline numbers were just as bad as the Great Depression in the 1930s. But it's the depression that nobody ever talks about. Why? Because the government didn't do anything. In fact, they might have cut spending. I think they actually raised interest rates. And sure enough, there was some severe pain in the economy. But after about 2 years, it recovers. And it was built back up on a foundation that was strong when you have the 1920s. Now compare that to Germany. Germany decided not to take the pain. They didn't want to deal with austerity. They wanted to keep the money printing going. So they actually started printing more money. And I think most people would be shocked to know that the hyperinflation of Weimar Germany happened in most of it in 1923. In 1920 to the end of 1921, almost, it might have even been into 1922, the value of their currency against the United States dollar went up. Let me say that another way, just to make sure you're getting it. Just 1 year prior to Germany going through hyperinflation, their currency over the previous 2 years gained value against the dollar. Another statistic that I think paints the picture well. In the middle or the beginning of 1922, the total amount of marks as their currency, I think it was a Reichsmark, the total amount in the entire planet Earth for people that had marks out overseas, just within Germany, the entire amount was about 160 billion marks. That's the entire money supply that existed. About 1 year later, it would have cost you 160 billion marks to buy a newspaper. Think about that. That would be, let's say that right now in the United States, M2 money supply is, call it 20 trillion, the way that they measure it. Now there's some flaws in that, but let's just say, and that's just the dollars that are in the United States. That does not include the dollars that are outside of the United States. But let's just assume for a moment that those are all the dollars that exist. 20 trillion. Imagine if in 1 year's time from today, a newspaper would cost $20 trillion. That's what happened in Germany. And the point I really want to emphasize is the 2 years prior, the Reichsmark wasn't plummeting in value to where, oh my gosh, you can see this coming a mile away. The mark was going up. It was appreciating in value compared to the dollar, compared to other currencies. So what I'm saying there is just think about the dollar going up on the DXY, going from, what is it today, 93, 94? Goes from 93, 94, it goes up to 100, it goes up to 110, 115 over the next 2 years. And 3 years later, it costs you $20 trillion for a newspaper. That is how quickly hyperinflation can hit. And that is why they say you don't want to get that inflation genie out of the bottle, because once you do, it's real hard to get her back in. You don't want to mess with inflation. I don't want to sound too alarmist, because you could see they were increasing their money supply at a lot faster rate, to a greater degree than we're doing it in the United States. But you need to go back and look at the metrics, and you need to understand the degree that they increased their money supply. So then you can compare that to what we're doing in the United States to try to figure out the probabilities of us maybe not going down the hyperinflation path, but in 5-10 years being in the 1970s type mode. Jeff Snyder says there's a dollar shortage because there's a need for money supply to extend to create value, and that deflation would create problems. Do you agree? I do. I don't know. I don't know if we're going to see deflation. I think we definitely could see deflation over the short term, maybe year or two. I think long term, like I've been saying, that inflation is kind of the outcome. You got to devalue the currency. But over the next year or two, who knows? You definitely could see a dollar. I don't know if there's a, I don't know if I'd say a dollar shortage, but you could definitely see a significant demand for dollars that would increase the value on the DXY. But see, that doesn't necessarily mean that the cost of consumer goods is going down. You can have asset price deflation while consumer goods are going up. The 1970s was a great example of that. From 72 to 4, the stock market went down 50% in nominal terms. So this was at a time when the cost of consumer goods and services were going up by 10% per year, and the stock market goes down by 50%. So you've got it. When you're talking about inflation, deflation, you've got to figure out what exactly you're talking about. But I mean, really, and I don't want to put words in Jeff's mouth, because I think Jeff is one of my favorites. I have an immense amount of respect for him. So I don't want to even imply that I think I know where he's coming from. But by the way, Jeff Snyder is going to be at the Rebel Capitalist Live. So sign up for Rebel Capitalist Live and you can meet him in face to face and ask him this question. Anyway, shameless plug there. But Jeff's thing is the euro dollar market just isn't producing the amount of dollars that it used to. It's broken. It's and therefore the banking system really has the control of the money supply when you combine M2, the way the government measures it, with the money supply in the shadows that no one really knows the amount of, like how many dollars are in the shadows in the euro dollar system. Nobody knows. So Jeff's point usually is, okay, well, M2 money supply might have gone up by 25%. And okay, yeah, that looks a little scary. But if the euro dollar market is producing, let's say, 25% fewer dollars in the form of new loans because the economy's doing so poorly, and if the euro dollar market is bigger than just what we see domestically in people's banks, bank accounts, then that means that the money supply is actually decreased, not increased, when you look at it in aggregate total and not just a small subsection. So, and Jeff is a guy that believes that, I don't want to say that he believes that, because I've talked to Emil about this, Kalinowski, and I think that Jeff maybe leans toward the Milton Friedman view that inflation and deflation is really always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. And that it if we see that interest rates are at 1%, as an example, what that the bond market is telling us is that the amount of money supply is actually decreasing in the shadows. And I think that maybe Jeff's argument might be that, yes, the government is creating a ton of money right now and spending it into the economy, but that's going to be temporary. And once we get through this temporary supply shock, then there's so much debt in the system and there's not enough dollars being created. Everything is going to continue to collapse in on itself once we go through this kind of eye of the deflationary storm. But even Jeff, and again, I hate to tell you how he thinks, but from what I understand in my conversations with Jeff, he's not saying that the price of food is going to go down, that you're going to be buying your burrito for half the cost next year as you're paying this year, or the price of your milk is going to be a fraction of what you're paying today. So don't buy milk today at, I don't know what the hell milk costs, $3 a gallon or whatever. Don't buy it today. Make sure, try to hold off until next year, because you'll buy it for a nickel a gallon. That's not what he's saying. They kind of use the term deflation and disinflation synonymously. So he's just talking about a lower rate of inflation. But as far as asset prices, then that you can see some significant deflation there.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
The free market does not price in externalities correctly, pollution, education, to the societal supply demand level. Should government be involved in no. I don't know how there's an argument for government being involved in education. I mean, the government doesn't do anything well. So why on earth would you want to delegate probably the most important job in our society, raising our children, to the government? I don't think that's wise. As far as pollution, I guess there could be an argument there for a pollution type tax maybe, but you got to remember, Max, when you're dealing with the government, you're dealing with Hannibal Lecter. Most people see the government as a panacea. That, oh, well, if we've got a problem, well, I mean, man, let's just have the government fix it. or if we need a bail, let's just have the government do it. If there's a hurricane, let's have the government come in and fix everything. If we need money, you know, let's just have the government print it and do this. Let's just have the government do that. The government, this willy-nilly, just, oh, no downside, no consequences. Let's just have the government do it. But if you viewed the government the way that Jodie Foster viewed the Hannibal Lecter character in Silence of the Lambs, we would have a much different attitude. So think about that. Oh, we've got a problem deciding what to eat for lunch. Oh, let's just go ask Hannibal Lecter. Oh, no problem. He'll tell us what to eat. Oh, boy, Johnny needs help with his homework. Oh, no problem. Let's just have Hannibal Lecter help him out. When you say it in those terms, you're like, oh, well, George, that's ridiculous. Of course, we're not going to have Hannibal Lecter help Johnny with his homework. But why is that more ridiculous than saying, let's have the government help Johnny with his homework, or let's have the government decide what we should eat for lunch, or let's have the government decide what we should put into our own bodies? When if you think about the incentives and the motivations of the politicians, it's simply to do whatever they need to do to be reelected and to gain power. And unfortunately, the more power you give the government, the more crazy people will seek out those positions. So just think, let's think about this. If there's a little teeny weeny government, let's say in St. Bart's, 9,000 people, you got a little mayor or something like that, maybe they can put in a street light. You're probably going to have some local firefighter or maybe the school principal or whatever want to be the mayor, and, you know, it's just a little side job, and they just do it because they like the community. But they really, in the grand scheme of things, they really can't do anything. They don't really have they don't have any power. So you're not going to get power-thirsty people applying for the position. On the other hand, just think if you've got a position that is the most powerful person on the entire planet Earth, the president of the United States, assuming they're, I know it's debatable, but let's just assume that's the most powerful position on the planet Earth. Are you going to get humble public servants applying for that position? Or are you going to get people with an insatiable lust for power? And then you got to think through, how do you get elected? Well, the person that gets elected is the person that lies the most, the person that's the best liar, the person that has no moral backbone, the person that's willing to tell you whatever you need to hear in order to vote for them. They have no principles. They have no ethics. They would sell their own grandmother in order to get a vote. Why? Because they have an insatiable lust for power. So the more power you give the government, the more people, the more crazies, the more people that have an insatiable lust for power are attracted to those positions. And those are the people that are now in charge of what you put into your body, of what you eat for lunch, and what we teach Johnny and Sally in second grade science class. It's Hannibal Lecter. It's no different. So let's just rework the question here. The free market does not price in externalities correctly, pollution, education, etc. To the societal supply-demand level, should Hannibal Lecter be involved in fixing these? No, Hannibal Lecter should not be involved in fixing those, because we should only use Hannibal Lecter when we absolutely just don't have any other option. That is a last resort. I think we'd all be better off if we viewed government the same way. Could you mention some more general investment philosophies, strategies that you followed throughout your life for a 20-year-old with 10K? Well, Matisse, you got to remember, I didn't know anything about investing until I retired. I didn't know what an interest rate was, barely. I didn't know what the Federal Reserve was. I didn't know what a yield curve was. I didn't know the difference between bonds and stocks. I had no clue. And then I retired and I started to dig into it and research it for myself. So, I mean, if I was your age, $10,000, I mean, I'd start flipping cars and flipping trucks to turn that 10 into 100 as quickly as I can. And then I'd think about investing the 100, but I know you're not asking that question. So I'd probably just set up my 10-80-10 portfolio. So 10% insurance, 80% investments that pay you to own them, and then 10% in speculative assets that might not pay you to own them, but they've got good asymmetry, meaning very little downside, hopefully a lot of upside. Okay, that would be physical gold would be on the insurance side of that. That's the 10%. Then of the 80% that pays you, we're talking about dividend paying stocks. We're talking about real estate, positive cash flow. Right now it's tough in the United States, maybe outside if that's an option. And then the other 10% in a speculative asset like maybe gold miners, uranium, Bitcoin, etc. Now your age at 20 years old, you got some wiggle room in there. I don't know that I'd do a 10-80-10. I might do a 10-50-40 because you can take on a significant amount of risk at that age, but I wouldn't be stupid about it. You know, I wouldn't take Bitcoin and go 100% of my portfolio. I wouldn't do 100% of my portfolio in anything. Gold miners, gold, I don't think that's wise. So, but I would maybe increase the size of the speculative portion of the portfolio to have some more upside to get you some more increased purchasing power because you've got so much more time to make back the money, even if you lose. And by the way, at your age, even if you lose, I think that's still kind of a good thing to a certain degree, as long as you're using the loss of money as a lesson. So I think the only true loss you can have in investing is if you don't learn anything. If you just lose money and you don't learn how to correct your mistakes, and if it doesn't improve your process or your ability to think, then yes, it's a loss. But if you lose, let's say $5,000, and that teaches you what you need to be successful long term, then I think that $5,000 was very well spent. So anyway, that's kind of how I'd tailor that around your individual circumstances. With just the limited amount of information you gave me, but I don't know anything else. So I wouldn't take that as investment advice. I'm just trying to tell you what I would do if I was in your situation. Okay, guys, got to get to this kind of little emergency I've got. So let me do some shout outs quickly. We've got Stephen Odlin, Lucas Juan Cabrera, Eric Blust, Scott Andrew, Cody Herr, Lloyd Braun, Leon Wang, Becky B, Moody, the Millennial, DF, Alan Krentz, Randy, Sparta Tech 9, Vet Bro, RR, Christopher Erickson, All Nighter Hider, Leslie V. All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your evening, and I will see you on the next video. If you'd like to hang out with me, some like-minded rebel capitalists, and some of the people that I interview on the Rebel Capitalist Show, check out rebelcapitalist.com/live.com. Thank you very much, guys. Thanks for hitting the notification bell to come onto the live stream in the first place, and we'll see you soon. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.